It's a real pleasure to introduce Sumanto Al-Qurtubi today. Sumanto currently is a research fellow at the Joan B. Kroc International Peace Institute at Notre Dame University. And he's also the Secretary General of the Nahdlatul Ulama community in North America. And I hope you might tell us a little bit about what that is, Sumanto. Sumanto got a PhD in anthropology from Boston University last spring. And before that, he did his master's here in the Center for Justice and Peacebuilding, so many of us learned to know him during that time. Prior to that, he did a master's in sociology of religion at Satchavacana Christian University in Salatiga, Indonesia, and that, I would say, is the reason that he is here today. His advisor there was Professor Mesak Krisetia, who is an Indonesian Mennonite leader and who approached me and encouraged MCC, at that time I was the MCC Area Director for Central and Southern Asia, MCC to consider sponsoring Sumanto to do the master's here in the Center for Justice and Peacebuilding. It sounded like a good idea to us, and so he did come here. While he was here, Sumanto wrote a book entitled Among the Believers, and I have a photocopy of the cover of that book. It's written in Bahasa Indonesian, but it has a great picture of either some Amish women or conservative Mennonites, I'm not sure. But it's about his experience while he was here living in the EMU community. And he told me it's in its sixth printing in Indonesia. So it's and the minister of religion has bought a lot of copies himself to distribute, to promote interfaith engagement and good relations among the faith communities. Sumanto is going to be talking to us today about his research on a major conflict situation in Indonesia between Christian and Muslim communities. It's something that I used to read a lot about in the news, but I'm anxious to hear his analysis of that, about the role of religion in the conflict and as well as in peacemaking. So Sumanto, thank you for coming. We're glad to have you here. We would invite you to speak for 45 minutes or so, and then we would like to have some time for questions and discussion. So, it's yours.
Well, thank you, Ed. Ed Martin was exactly the man who sent me to the CGP a long time ago, I think 2006 or 2000, yeah, January 2006, when I began my master degree at Center for Justice and Peacebuilding, and then I finished 1 year and a half in August 2007, and I moved to Boston University to pursue my PhD. It's for four and a half years, and then I've just finished last spring, and I'm now moved to Notre Dame and Kroc Institute for International Peace Studies. First of all, thank you for coming. Actually, the first time I would like to study about, would like to discuss about religion, conflict, and peacemaking, but yesterday I changed a little bit about the topic because there are some overlapping between my talk here and tomorrow in CGP. So I decided yesterday I will talk about religion and violence here and tomorrow about religion and peace at CGP. So to those who would like to hear more about the idea of how peacemaking is going on in Ambon and Maluku, and then come to my lecture tomorrow at CGP. So I'm now focusing on how religion and play in the conflict setting in Ambon or Maluku. So this is the reason why I defined the topic. If you see Ambon, you can see Ambon is right there. So, so I will begin before explaining about violence in Ambon. I think it is good to explain about the political transitions in Indonesia, because the Ambon tragedy was happened during the political transition. So on May to the in 1998, Indonesia witnessed a dramatic and historic event: the fall of Suharto, led new order dictatorial regime that had been in power for over 32 years. So Suharto is there. I put his picture, his dictatorial regime at the time. The long ruling Suharto, so he was in power from 1966 until 1998, so about 32 years, was toppled by a people power as a result of a collaboration of secular Muslims and non-Muslim middle-class societies, democracy activists, students, and some political elites. Following the economic crisis that hit this world's largest Muslim country beginning in late 1997. In the beginning, the process of a Suharto transition went very peacefully. Unlike other undemocratic countries which commonly turn to deadly violence after revolution has taken place, Indonesia's political transition, at least at first, remained relatively peaceful. The country thus had been widely featured as a Muslim nation which was successful in handling the political shift from an authoritarian military regime to a democratic civilian government. If you look at the picture over there, there's a huge mass of students, of university students in 1998, in May 1998. And this building actually is the house of legislation building. So the students on the top of the legislation building offices all use some kind of demonstration to push the president Suharto step down from the political
position,
from the presidency. This nice picture of peaceful of non-violent transition to democracy, however, was soon shattered by widespread outbursts of deadly sectarian conflict and vicious ethno-religious communal violence in the months following Suharto's overthrow. The intergroup violent conflict occurred not only in Java's main town and places, but also in outer Indonesia. The violence resulted in the displacement of some 1.5 million refugees, the deliberate destruction of urban and suburban areas, thousands of casualties, and a plague of criminality and public lynching. So at the beginning, the process of transition, of political transition, went very peacefully, just in the beginning. But, and then after that, months later, and then became a very crowded, very chaotic, many violent conflict happened in Indonesia, from Aceh to Papua, including in Ambon. So of all the communal conflict to erupt in Indonesia after 1999, the religious violence in Ambon, one of the country's largest urban centers, was the most appalling in terms of scale of the death and destruction. The Ambon upheaval resulted in tens of thousands of deaths. And this is not only a people, but also including dogs, because some Muslim jihadists consider dogs to be Christians. But they consider cat more Islamic rather than than dogs during the conflict. Not only people, some jihadists kill dogs because they consider dogs to be part of Christianity. A thousand of injuries, about a third of half of the population was displaced, and countless properties were burned down. The Maluku Mayhem,
was also among the most complex in terms of actors involved in the conflict, stages of violence, and motives behind the tragedy. A part of the 1975 and 1999 savage military onslaught in East Timor, the violence in Ambon, Maluku, and North Maluku from 1999 to 2004 was the most shocking violence seen in the history of Indonesia since anti-communist pogrom of 1965 until 1966. The violent conflict between Christian and Muslim from various ethnic groups in Indonesia and Maluku. Maluku is the province, and Ambon is the provincial capital of the Maluku province. And also North Maluku, in the northern part of Maluku province, began on January 19, 1999, and continued for more than 4 years. Prior to the eruption of the communal conflict, many people in Ambon and Maluku believe that the famous Ambonese traditional system of intergroup brotherhood would prevail over any menace of violence. Ambon has also been famous for its jargon, Ambon Manise, the sweet Ambon, which is the common trope in everything from official speeches to pop song and so on and so forth. But this traditional wisdom was not working at the time. The Maluku conflict was finally transformed into deadly, large-scale, violent conflict. And that happened in, especially in the mid-2007, in the mid-2000, actually, after the group of Laskar Jihad. You can see the picture over there, a group of Laskar Jihad. That picture, actually, in Jakarta. That's in Ambon, and that in Jakarta, group of Laskar Jihad, about thousands group, and came from Jakarta and some part from Java, and they went to Ambon to help their Muslim fellows in Ambon. After this group came to Ambon in Maluku, and then the violence became more complicated because many actors and so on and so forth involved in the violence. So Laskar Jihad commander at the time, not only from Java but also Laskar Jihad commander in Ambon, they described the Maluku conflict as a holy war against the evil effort of United States-led Zionist cum Christian conspiracy. Some elite of the Ambonese radical Christian group, or there are some Christian radical group also in Ambon, like Cokar, Kuda Putih, the Front, Kedaulatan, Maluku, and so on and so forth, depicted the violent conflict in a similar bipolar manner, blaming state-backed policies that favor Muslim group for the Christian loss of control over local cultural, political, and economic resources. As a result of this escalated violence, the previously stable Ambon became the site of devastating interreligious war. And this was the first time in the history of Indonesia where Christian and Muslim were involved in such massive warfare. The first time in Indonesian history that a large group of Christian and Muslim were involved in violent, brutal conflict that resulted in tens of thousands of deaths. And you can check this issue in International Crisis Group, Human Rights Watch, and so on and so forth, about the brutality of this conflict. So I will begin by explanation of how Christian fighters describe the war, and I will follow by how Muslims describe the war. So I will explain Christian first, Christian perspective first, and then we'll follow it by a Muslim. He is a friend of mine during my field work in Ambon. I was in Ambon in from January 2010 until I think about 14 months I live in Ambon City, and he is one of the commander of Christian commander at the time. It's, there are many Christian commander. He is one of them, and he has become close a friend of mine right now. And you can see how he described the Christian Muslim conflict at the time. An ex Christian fighter of Ambon taught me that the role of religion during the Maluku War was not only important but very important. Christian and Muslim fought and killed each other due to their religion being humiliated by other religious communities. Because of religion, Christian and Muslim in Ambon were involved in the wars for 5 years since 1999. So this ex-commander of the Christian commander said, "The Ambon War was a sacred war, so that whoever killed Muslim will be rewarded a paradise by God." He also thought that the Ambon War is a medium of self-purification from my previous sins and negative behaviors. He taught me he killed countless Muslims during the conflict, and I will explain also next. Ex-Laskar Jihad, ex-jihadist, Muslim jihadist also killed a number of Christians. For the Christian warriors like Peter Manuputi, the Maluku War was regarded as Perang Salib or the Crusade, intended to guard Christianity from the Muslim da'wah or Islamic propagation and forced conversion. And the second point is to defend the Maluku territory, which they saw as Christian land, referring to the Canaan land in the biblical tradition. Since Ambonese Christian warrior saw the Maluku conflict as a sacred war, performing religious song was a feature in the battleground. On January 20, in 1999, a large group of Christian warriors left the Rehoboth Church in Ambon City and repeatedly sang the following. I don't know, this song is derived from, they sang, "We don't want to go back. We had won with the blood of Christ. We had won with his blood." So this song repeatedly sang by, the large of Christian fighter during the conflict. The Christian fighter also, according to Christian schools, he is a German anthropologist, he said there are about 25 Christian militias groups, and each militia is consisting of 100 until 200 members. So there are about 25 until 30 Christian militias group. That each group has 100 until 200 member that operating not only in Ambon City, but also across the Moluccan province. They also sang at the time Maju Laskar Christus, or Onward Christian Soldiers. So they translated the song, the famous song in Christian, Onward Christian Soldiers, and they translated into Indonesians, and they marched and they sang this song with other Christian fellows. By Ambonese Christian, particularly the warriors, Onward Christian Soldier was considered to be march of war. During the conflict, the song was indeed helpful for Christian fighter to arouse the spirit of war. A Christian woman in Ambon City taught to me, when we were attacked or engaged in the war, she said, along with other Christian women, sang that song, that means Onward Christian Soldier, while beating death's pan to arouse the enthusiasm of fighting. By singing this song, we felt we were getting a new spirit and courage in the face of enemies, that means Muslim. In the morning, in December 2000, it's still a lot of story here, a group of about 40 Christian young men and women from the Ambon City, so they walked down to the Patimura Street in Ambon Town. They were brandishing their long knife and spear, and again were singing the Indonesian version of Onward Christian Soldiers. In front of them walked young female Protestant minister in official black vestment, carrying Moses stick. She thought discovered Moses stick in the wood, and I brought this Moses stick to be used in the conflict setting. So the role of Protestant priests and church ministries were central during the conflict. They had served not only as a canal to distribute the information and issues about the development of conflict, they received from their Christian center or POSCO to the local Christian communities and fighters, but also led ritual ceremonies. Before the fighter went to the combat zone, gave blessing to the combatants, and ran a Sunday sermon to motivate the Laskar Christus, or the Christian soldier. Laskar Christus means Christian soldier, and who attended the Christian church at the time. So, a common themes delivered in the sermon of Khotbah Minggu often deal with issues of Israel's struggle to occupy the land of Canaan in the times of Kings David and Solomon. Ambonist conservative Christians depicted themselves as part of tribes of Israel, or Israelite, and portrayed the land of Ambon as the land of Canaan, whereas Muslims were represented as Goliath and a villainous that conquered and took over Ambon, which they saw at the time as belong to their Christian ancestors. So verses in the Bible talking about Israelites who entered the land of Canaan and were ordered by God to drive out the Amalek. Oh, maybe Pak Lawrence can talk more about what Amalek, both people and its animal, and he mentioned Amalek's theology of Amalek, and were used by some pastor and church leader to justify the obligation of the wars against a Muslim. This religious duty in particular is set forth in the verse, "The Lord will have war with Amalek from generation to generation." So they use the theology of Amalek to justify the war against the Muslim. Over the course of the conflict, local pastor, church ministries, and official were responsible to choose particular biblical verses and religious texts to be applied in the Sunday sermon and other religious services based on socio-political context and development. Generally, pastor and church ministers selected popular biblical verses in the Old Testament talking about violence and struggle of the Israelites against their enemies to be used in the religious services, such as the books of Genesis, Deuteronomy, Exodus, Joshua, Judges, Samuel, and so on and so forth. During the conflict, ordinary Protestants also recited these verses wherever and whenever they went to other places or to the battleground. The Christian warrior carried a small Bible in their pocket for self-protection, making it easier to recite the popular verses and waging the spirit of the war. Whatever verses were cited by the pastor and church elite, one thing that is obvious is that they use Bible, particularly Old Testament, to seek theological foundation or to legitimize acts of violence or self-defense war. Many Ambonist Christians many Ambonist Christians at the time, I'm not talking Ambonist Christian right now, associated themselves as the Israelite or the Israeli people as described in the Bible, who suffered, and consequently they need to fight against Muslims to gain victory and freedom from suffering. Not only that, Ambonist Christians imagine themselves as Israeli tribes narrated in the Bible. If Israeli tribe fought against the people of the Philistine, Amalek, Egypt, and so on and so forth, Ambonist Christian battle against Muslim whom they saw at the time as a representation of the foes of the Israelite. So this kind of interesting story, how the Christian fighter used Old Testament to justify their violent acts against a Muslim. The militant Christian were convinced that God would help and protect them from the Muslim enemies as he helped and protected the Israeli. So, in other words, God was portrayed as the hero, helper, and guardian of Ammonish Christian and who would destroy Muslim enemies. So a lot of story about Ambonese Christian right now. Since Ambonese Christian believe that the Ambon War is a sacred duty granted by God, throughout the conflict they, I thought but Christian fighters, purified themselves by actively conducting ritual practices, religious sermon and services, reading the Bible, practicing God's order, following the rules of war and avoiding wrongdoings as instructed by the Holy Book. According to the Christian fighters, the rules of war they practiced during the conflict included the ban of initiating the attack, the ban of robbery of properties belonging to opposing group, that is Muslim, prohibition of mocking or ridiculing the other, the ban of torturing the opposing people. In addition, the Christian fighters prohibited to have conflict with their wife or parents before going to the combat zone, of talking of the name of Jesus in proper places or insulting other religion, and of transgressing the Ten Commandments of the Torah. All of these things were considered to be the taboos of war that would contaminate the mission of holy wars against the Christian. So the interesting question is that why did Ambonese Christian use Old Testament and not New Testament as a biblical or as religious justification? Why did they prefer David to Jesus in the name in the time of conflict? So the answer is so obvious, very clear, because the New Testament, many Muslim Ambonese Christian taught to me, the New Testament teach peace, not violence, love, not hate, and brotherhood, not conflict, while the Old Testament contains heroic stories in the warfare, whereas Jesus taught his follower and pupil to love their enemies. David went to the battlefield against Goliath. So an ex-Ambonese Christian fighter taught to me, during the time of conflict, every Sunday, he said, the verses he recited were those of the Old Testament, particularly those having to do with the gloomy and heroic story of Israelite and the kings of Israelite, like Saul, David, Solomon, which were regarded at the time fitting into the Ambon social political setting. So what I try to explain here in how Christian fighters use religious discourses, religious stories, religious metaphor, religious narrative to justify their idea that the conflict in Ambon was truly religious war, according to them. So now back, enough talking about Christian, so now talking about how Muslim, how the Muslim perceive to the Ambon war or conflict. So this picture is a Laskar Jihad group. The Laskar Jihad mean a jihadist soldiers, quote by quote. This is not Ambonese, but this group came from Java. But there are many jihadist groups in Ambon, actually. Not only Laskar Jihad from Java. There are many jihadist groups that also involved during the conflict. So let's see what the Muslim jihadists said about the conflict. Is that similar thing to the Christian or not? So this is what the ex-jihadist said about the Christian. You can see he is also my friend. I him I work with him, and he is a wonderful person. He is now a teacher in Islamic College in Ambon City. He is not jihadist right now. He is transforming some violent ideas into peaceful means. So you can see what he said. When the communal conflict erupted in Ambon in 1999, the only thing that Ambonese Muslims thought was waging jihad fisabilillah, or jihad in the Allah path, in the God path. If there were a child or member of the family who died in the battleground, they were happy because they died as a martyr, so would be guaranteed immediate admission to heaven. When the dead bodies were brought to the to their home villages, they were enthusiastically welcomed by people with the shouting of Allahu Akbar, or God is great, and crying, not because sadness, but cheerfulness. Before going to the battlefield, the jihadis were gathered in a mosque to receive advice from local imam, mosque staff or ta'mir, and raja, head of nagri. They commonly advised on a number of activities that were considered as taboo during the war for time. This taboo included the prohibition of insult, mocking, vile remark, the ban of using dirty words, the prohibition of robbing or stealing, the prohibition of drunkenness. In addition to these taboos, the jihadis were advised to conduct good things like salat or praying. People who had previously committed forbidden activities based on Sharia law, such as stealing and gambling, didn't do so such activities during the Ambon War because they were feared that this particular act would contaminate their sacred jihad struggle and mission. Thus, during the conflict, the level of people's religiosity and piety became very high. In the aftermath of the conflict, many of these actions returned to normal, stealing and gambling again. You can see how they perceived the onwards conflict. So it is clear that they thought that the image of the Ambon War was a religious violence in which religious identities, symbol, and discourses became a significant contributing element of the conflict. So I tried to distribute a questionnaire survey at the time, and it was surprising for me because more than 85 until 90% of the people who were involved in the conflict, and they believed so, that the conflict was very much influenced by religious identities. So they believed that the conflict at the time was a religious or sacred conflict. Most Ambonese Muslim jihadists also believe that the Ambon War was a sacred war for a number of reasons. First, because religion became the main conduit of the mobilization in the war. The second, the war was to defend Islamic faith and God from Christianization effort. The third, Christian attacked the Muslim dignity and honesty. Fourth, the war is God ordered or command to erect a God's word. Fifth, the Ambon War was a jihad fisabilillah, they said, jihad in God's path. Sixth, the Ambon War was honored in the ears of God. And seventh, the involvement of religious leaders in the conflict. So for Ambonese Muslim jihadis, the Ambon conflict was viewed as the creation of the Ambonese Christian and RMS supporter as a separatist group in Ambon and Maluku, who joined forces with international Christian Jewish communities, in particular in the United States, according to them, to destroy Islam and Muslim communities from the land of Maluku. They also believed that the battle was a means or tool to expand Christianity in the land recently dominated by Muslim, to convert Muslim, and finally to establish Christian state of Maluku. This is why most Muslims in Ambon, the war was regarded as a religious war to rescue Islamic faith from Christian infidels, quote by quote. Due to the perception that Ambon conflict was a holy war, when the jihadists gathered in the mosque before going to the battlefield, the imam, it means imam mean a in Ambon means a prayer leader, and Bapa Raja means a chief village, a village chief, and Tuan Guru, that means Islamic Muslim teacher, advised them about the rules of war, namely certain misconduct behavior or wrongdoing that could contaminate the jihad sacred mission. This include the prohibition of stealing, robbery, killing women and kids, mocking, rape, and drunkenness. So you can see the similarities between the Muslim jihadists and the Christian warrior in this sense. This perception changed after the coming of Java-based Laskar Jihad forces. I thought in previous scene. For the Laskar Jihad, the war properties belonging to the opposing religious group are allowed to be carried away or utilized because these were considered to be bounties of war. For the Laskar Jihad in Ambon, they didn't see that the bounties of war is allowed in the Muslim setting in Ambon. So there's a conflict between jihadists, non-Ambon jihadists and Ambon jihadists at the time because of different perception of the war. So the Ambonian jihadists, for example, the means determine the end. So this is among the reason why some faction of Ambonian jihadist group refuse to join with Laskar Jihad and prefer to acting independently. For most Ambonian jihadists, jihad is the most sacred duty of a Muslim because God commands and guarantees him a safe passage to paradise. So you can see there are many similarities between jihadists and Christian. So it is a good example of how to compare how the Muslim jihadist and the Christian warrior in this case. If you see the scene of there, Muslim jihadists considered the war in Ambon as Perang Sabil or Jihad Fisabilillah. For the Christian warrior, they considered as Perang Salib. For Christian use Quran as legitimation, from the Christian use biblical as justification, and so on and so forth. So you can see the difference, the similarities and difference over there. For the Christian to prevent Christian missionary, from the Christian to prevent Islamic propagation, from the Muslim side to prevent Christian missionary. So the difference is that for Muslim jihadists, death in the battlefield is considered to be a martyr, or mati syahid, or martyr. But for the Christian warrior at the time, death in the combat zones as a symbol of sinfulness and transgression of taboos of war. So if people died in the war, in the warfare, so they will not welcome them because they believe that they transgress some rules of war during the time. So, and the last one, death or living is under the is of God from the Muslim perspective, but for the Christian perspective, salvation is considered to be living. Salvation equal living. So the last comment of mine is that why I'm talking about religion and violence in this case? Because most profuse and existing scholarship in Indonesia, especially in the Maluku conflict, mostly talking about political economy of conflict, and they do not talk about religious issues in this sense. They consider religion to be marginal issues. So academic observer also tend to downplay the role of religion in the conflict setting, in the conflict setting, insisting that the what appears to be religious war is upon closer analysis really motivated by political interests, socioeconomic and territorial grievances that are mobilized and manipulated by the greedy elites, outside provocator and agents of a conflict. So I don't agree entirely with statement proposed by the Laskar Jihad commander of the Christian militias commander that portrayed the Maluku war as truly religious war. However, neither should we dismiss the religious justification of violence by those involved in the conflict as evidence of false consciousness or public falsehood. So that means the violence in God's name is not simply a spurious cover for grievance and greed. Religion played a complex role in determining the trajectory and shaping the intensity of violence. Religion was not only used as a mean of provocation and by interest group, but also simultaneously heightened the emotion of combatants, facilitated the mobilization of militias, determined the form of that mobilization, and provided the ideology that sustained those militias in the field. The use of religious doctrine, teaching, and symbols by ordinary Christian and Muslim militias to legalize fighting, killing, and other forms of violence, along with the fear of Christian and Muslims throughout their life, and the sustainability of their faith made violent conflict more intense and vicious. Many Muslims declare an obligation, willingness, and enthusiasm to wage jihad rhetorically to prevent Christian expansion and missionarism in the predominantly Christian city of Ambon. In addition, a large number of Muslim militias joined the Pasukan Jihad or the jihadist group were motivated by what Chris Wilson called the jihadist principle, desire to defend Islam and defeat those who had attacked Muslim. So the Christian group in Ambon put emphasis on religious solidarity and symbolism as a vehicle of mobilizing the unity and courage needed to oppose and fight against the Muslim militias and the rioters. Members of the Protestant churches also evoked Christian sentiment for mobilizing combatants. Christians wore large crosses in the battlefield and proclaimed their struggle to protect Christianity and other Christian fellows in Ambon and elsewhere in Maluku. There were many Christians said that their ultimate objective during the conflict was to defend Jesus. So this is the final word of mine. So you can see although many people tend to downplay, to underestimate the role of religion, in fact, for Ambonese Christian and a Ambonese Christian warrior and Muslim jihadist, they consider religion to be significant in a conflict. So while religion never acted autonomously as a cause of conflict, ignoring its role completely would preclude a proper understanding of much of the violence in Ambon and Maluku. Throughout the region's communal violence, religious sentiment, material interest, and political motive interacted with one another, magnifying and altering the influence each would have had in isolation. Take away one factor, such as religious tension, economic inequality, or political competition, the violence would not occur. This is to say that although religion did matter during the Ambon conflict, it is also too simple to reduce the complexity of the conflict to just a matter of religion without investigating the political economy of being Christian and Muslim in the Maluku social field. So what I try to say in this case is that although religion, religious discourses, teaching, symbol, metaphors, and so on and so forth clearly figure during the Ambon conflict, this also doesn't mean that everything in Ambon is about religion. There was no political or economic aspect of the conflict. I discuss this simply because if you're familiar with the literature on scholarship on the Ambon conflict, they tend to overemphasize the role of military forces, for example, the role of political leaders in Jakarta, the role of the gangster in Jakarta, the roles of and so on and so forth, and neglect the local voices, neglect the Christian and Muslim voices in Ambon. So I tried to discover this issue and bring to the public, to the audience, because, well, Ambon is maybe one side as a victim, but other side, Ambonese people also perpetrators of the conflict. So Ambon's both Christian and Muslim, both victim and actors of the conflict, do not neglect the
the role of Ambonese Muslims and Christians during the communal conflict in Ambon. I think this is what I'm saying, and we can talk later, develop later in a discussion. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you so much, Samanto. I think this is it's a tremendous case study of a situation that some of us watched from afar and wondered, you know, it was always portrayed as Christian-Muslim conflict, and you've shown us that that was a very important aspect of it, but not the only element that was important. So I think your work is very important, and I'm glad you were able to present it to us today. I'm sorry we were not getting to the way in which religion contributed to peace, but that's the advertisement for tomorrow's CJP learning lunch at in the dining room. But we'll open it up for questions. I'll let you field the questions. And anyone asking a question, please go to the mic, because we're trying to record this as a podcast and want to get your question on the tape as well.
Well, this is good to say about the bad first and then the good later. So tomorrow we're talking about the good things in CJP.
So I hope everybody comes tomorrow.
So this is talking about the bad news first, and tomorrow we're talking about the good news.
The question I'm interested in, perhaps you would say much more about it in your tomorrow's speech on religion and peace in that area, but very briefly, at least for me today, is to know a bit more about kind of internal diversity within the Christian and Muslim communities, particularly in terms of religious scholars and religious leaders in each community disputing the kind of view that you presented that would lead to more peaceful understanding of Christianity and Islam in these two communities, that would somehow encourage more peaceful interpretation of both traditions. And who had the stronger voice? And do we have now a peaceful situation there where hopefully these more peaceful interpretations of the two religions...
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I'm not talking about the radical faction.
Yeah.
So I'm talking about the religious militants of violence. So tomorrow we're talking about religious militants for peace.
Yeah.
So there's a dynamic, lot of dynamic. From the Christian perspective, this interesting point here is that from the Christian militants of peace, for the peacemaker, Christian peacemaker, they try to discover, they try to avoid Old Testament. They use New Testament to establish as a theological foundation of peace. So they have spread this message across the Christian congregation, across the Maluku provinces. And a war is wrong. Muslim is not our enemies. Muslim is our friend. So we have to use, as a Christian, we have to rise to Jesus' teachings, love enemy, and so on and so forth, and do not try to... So the battle at the time, the battle of thoughts, and not only battle of thoughts, but in some cases they fight each other. Like in Congress, in Christian Congress, there is a huge supporters of a Christian radicals, also huge supporters of Christian peacemakers. So both many Christian friends of mine thought me that during the Congress. I'm talking about a Moluccan Christian church. So this is the biggest Christian congregation in Maluku. It has more than 500,000 members in this congregation. So this is the biggest Christian congregation in Maluku. During the Congress, there's not only battle of thought, actually, but they fight. Fight each other because of use the difference. Oh yeah, there are a lot of dynamic. And tomorrow I'm going to talk about the dynamic of peacemaking, and not only in Christian but also in a Muslim. Many moderate Muslims at the time refused the idea of jihad, and also they refused
to when Lashkar Jihad group, the jihadist group, came from Jaffa, I saw and sight. When the Lashkar Jihad, here we go. This, well, where? I see. This one. Here we go. This group is not Ambonese. This group is from Java, from Jakarta in particular. When they came to Ambon, and many Muslim group refused to accept this group because they thought at the time this group will make a conflict more complicated rather than to solve the conflict in Ambon. So there's a lot of dynamic, of course, during the conflict, and we'll talk in tomorrow. If you like to attend, would be happy to talk tomorrow.
Hi. I think you said that at this time there was, when Suharto fell, there was violence throughout Indonesia, but in Ambon it was the worst? Is that what you said?
Sorry?
I believe that you said that when Suharto fell...
Suharto fell, yeah.
There was violence throughout Indonesia?
After Suharto.
But Ambon was the worst?
Ambon is the worst. Okay. Ambon was the worst, yeah.
So my question is, can you speak to whether the violence throughout Indonesia had the same texture as in Ambon, where it had these three aspects coming together to create an awful situation, or was it different in the other areas of Indonesia?
Well, of course, the many dynamic. There are many differences. The religion in nature, quote by quote, is only in Ambon, actually. Ambon and Maluku. The rest of the conflict in Indonesia, such as Kalimantan, if you see in Kalimantan cases, it's more ethnic-based conflict between Maduris and Kalimantan or Malay is more driven by a ethnicity, ethnic group, migrant and non-migrants, and so on and so forth. It's very strong in Kalimantan. In Papua, if you look at issues in Papua and Aceh, it's more a separatist group where people try to spare it from the central government of Indonesia. So their dynamic of conflict in violent conflict in Indonesia not the same in this case. There are many studies actually talking about these issues. And what surprised me is that during the Suharto, the conflict is more a state-based violence. That means a state that sponsors many state government official military forces, quote by quote, sponsor the violence during the Suharto reign. But after Suharto fell in 1998, the nature of conflict completely changed. This happened is not a state violence, but communal violence in this sense, because many ordinary people, ordinary folks involved in the violence. So using the old analysis of Suharto state violence is not quite right to analyze the current post-Suharto communal conflict. The many dynamic and many differences in
In speaking to a person that was in Ambon at that time, I understand that there were also occasions when sort of pre-Islamic or pre-Christian ideas and behaviors surfaced. In the conflict, things that sort of go beyond our imagination of what might happen in war, such as the way to really defeat your enemy and to be empowered by their power is that after you kill them, you eat them. I wonder how much of this there was, or if this would just be occasional events where something like that occurred.
You know, tell you more clearly about.
Well, this kind of coming up through the surface from the pre-Islamic cultural ways, pre-Islamic and pre-Christian.
Okay.
Because I don't think anybody would say that either Christians or Muslims included any ideas like you can really win the war and get the power from your enemy by physically eating them. But apparently that happened in certain events during this conflict. And I just wondered whether you... whether in your research you found occasions of things of that sort, and how much of it there was, and or if that was just a sort of just a rare occurrence.
You mean before the 1999?
No, I mean during the 1999 conflict. I mean the during that period, this person was describing incidents where this kind of thing occurred.
So maybe you can tell me, you can tell us more about you.
Well, she simply said that in certain occasions where there was conflict between the two sides. And,
in Ambon City? In Ambon City?
Yes.
Okay.
In I don't know if it was in Ambon City.
Okay.
But maybe so, or nearby. Where there were situations where a relative was killed, and partially eaten. I just wondered if maybe this was an unusual, a rare occurrence, or to what degree were there pre-Islamic impulses like that involved in this conflict?
Well, the in Ambon or Maluku in general, there is a traditions of war, and they still practice until today. The Cakalele dance in Ambon and Maluku, not only in Ambon province but also in northern part of Maluku, is very famous. The Cakalele dance is a represent of the pre-Islamic and pre-Christian traditions of war.
Yeah.
And it is very strong and still practices in today's in some part of the not in Ambon City but in some part of the Maluku and not Maluku provinces. But I believe there are many dynamics, it's very complicated. It's very difficult to generalize the case of the case by case of the Ambon conflict, of the Maluku conflict, because the conflicts not only in Ambon City, but from Tobelo, from Ternate, Tidore, in the northeast of the Maluku archipelago to the southeast Maluku archipelago. So there are a lot of dynamic, and I believe in different places, there are different dynamic and motivation and actor who involved in the conflict. So it might be in Pak Loren said, might be in the case in some, and I didn't hear that, but might be the case in some cases, but not in other places. But it's very complex. This is why my project, I didn't focus on the whole of violent conflicts in Maluku because this is too broad and too complicated. In some places, maybe religion is very significant element, but in other places, it's not religion, but maybe the idea of a migration, maybe because strong between local native and migrants and so on and so forth. So it's complicated. So this is why I try to narrow down my focus on the particular case, what I saw and I learned from the Christian and Muslim fellows, because I'm afraid I will misleading to talk about the Ambon conflict as a whole, from the northern, from the northern part of the Maluku to the southeastern region, is very broad and very complicated. And there are many issues, many stories, many ideas and tales during the conflict, and might be in some cases applied in what Pak Lawrence said.
Well, I would also simply say that that in my relationship with this person, there were many conversations about the conflict over months, and then and only after a long time were anything like this mentioned. So so they themselves were not making that the kind of thing that I just described a front and center kind of part of the conflict, but apparently it happened some places, sometimes, and it was something that was not talked about very much.
Mm. Yeah, I believe there were many brutality and so on and so forth. Yes, I hear many stories about that, and we can still find some pictures, some in the internet, such a, yeah.
A question I had was about doing your research and how ready were people to talk about the conflict? And I mean, you showed a few people that talked with you about it, but how do they feel now? And maybe we'll learn more about that tomorrow. But I just wondered. Is it something that they still live with very much, and were they ready to talk about it, or was it hard to draw them out?
Good question, Ed. In Ambon, my observation in Ambon right now is a sort of reconciliation without justice. What I'm trying to say is that this idea of reconciliation, some people and Christian and Muslim, but they were but justice in the sense of they never bring these issues to the front, because they're afraid that the idea of justice can lead to the to the continuing conflict. But what I'd like to say is that, yeah, in some Muslim, some Christians, they change their perspective right now. Some Christians, some Muslim, yes, but the condition right now in Ambon is that some jihadists, both Christian and Muslim, whom I'm talking right now, this is what they thought during the conflict in 1999 until 2002. After that, they changed. They changed the perspective of conflict as a religious war, because there are some dynamic in the conflict. There are some separatist group came in the conflict and tried to bring Maluku to spirit from the Indonesian government. And there was some terrorist group came in and then tried to explode everything. So there, after 2002, people began to change, both Muslim and Christian actually, began to change and realize that this was not religious war. They began to, because there were a lot of actors and so on and so forth involved in the conflict setting, and many people who have their own interests, political and economic interests, tried to mobilize people and to continue the war, and so on and so forth. But bit by bit, these jihadists, both Christian and Muslims, they were not willing to involve again in the war, and they refused to be mobilized by Christian and Muslim leaders to be involved in the war, because they believe that their sacred mission, the first mission, was manipulated later by some Christian and Muslim leaders for their own purposes.
So this is why it's interesting in this case. After 2002, there's still conflict in some places, but this conflict failed to attract the large audience. The people were no longer willing to involve in the conflict because, you only use my energy, you only use my body, but you manipulated me, you misused me, you mistreat me to your political and economic interest and so on and so forth. So this trend began change after 2002. And until now, actually, a communal conflict still happen in some places in Ambon City. Just recently, in 2011, there was also conflict in Ambon City between Christian and Muslim. And I was at the time become envoy of the Minister of Religious Affairs at the time to come to Ambon again to investigate the nature of the new conflict in Ambon. And I came there with three men, three persons came to the conflict setting in Ambon. I tried to look at and to interview, to connect with my old friends in Ambon, both Christian and Muslim, and they thought that, forget about the conflict. I'm not willing again. I'm not willing to involve in this such a crazy thing. So change happened. Views and so on and so forth happened because, and this is true. And that conflict in 2011 and after 2002 failed to attract the other Muslim and Christian, only in small places. So I would like to call localized conflict. So this is different from 1999 until 2002, where the conflict first in Ambon, began in Ambon, and suddenly, boom, not only in Ambon City, but in the countryside, in all across the Moluccan Islands, between Christian and Muslim, Catholic, Protestant, and Muslim, not only Ambon City, across the Moluccan archipelago. So it's completely different when in 2002 and until now, and people not willing again to. But the problem is that Christian and Muslim still live in segregation. This is the problem for Ambon right now and Maluku in general. They live in segregation. Even though they live in one village, one town, but they live in different block. Muslim in with the Muslim in one block and Christian in other block. So this is part of the dynamic of the conflict.
Thank you, Sumato. You talk about manipulation by political, economic leaders for their own benefits. I think we have to also ask the question, why do people react and respond to that manipulation? Manipulation of what? Identities? What they hold close to themselves in terms of their religious beliefs or understandings? That's a comment. A question is, what role did memory play in this conflict? And I would tie it actually to my previous statement, but I won't go into that. Memory of what happened in the 1960s? How much did the crusaders and their leaders, their pastors and priests, and the jihadists and their imams and so forth use the memory of the battles and the killings and the pain of the 1960s as a...
You're talking 1960s during...
Well, the chaos of that...
Communists?
Of that time. No, I'm talking about the... Didn't you not talk about Suharto and the tensions and the battles and the fighting and the violence after him?
Yeah.
Did people actually use that information, memory of those times, as a way of saying, remember what happened between Muslims and Christians then? If we don't attack, if we don't use violence against the other side, will they not conquer us? get rid of us, destroy us, eliminate us, take away who we are culturally, religiously, and our identities. The role of memory, that's the question. Did people in the churches and the mosques use it? Do you remember what happened? It's going to happen again if we don't attack. Did media use it? What was the role of memory, if anything?
In some cases, yeah, of course. But my discovery is that during the time, this is the interesting thing for me. Christian and Muslim use memory, but for different memories. For example, Christian at the time use they pass memories of a domination against a domination over the Muslims and so on and so forth to be used as a legitimacy of the conflict. But for the Muslim side, they use a memory of defeat during the last time in the history of Ambon and Maluku to be used as a means to take revenge to the Christian side. So they use memories, but they use different memories to legitimize their violence. Both memories, but different kinds of memories. Is that answer your question?
Yeah, to a it's a broader question.
Yeah. We can talk later.
Well, thank you very much, Sumanto.
I still have
you had a question, now. John?
Yes.
Well, go ahead then.
Let's see. What you've presented is a tremendous indictment of both Christianity and Islam. They've been around for thousands of years and have not been able to clearly differentiate that the violent play no role, is a fundamental heresy on either side. They've been able to differentiate lots of other things. They have voiced themselves very clearly vis-a-vis other things, but not clearly enough vis-a-vis violence, that they cannot be, we call it hijacked, fine, but those who are doing the hijacking call themselves the faithful, the most faithful. And even sometimes in the media, they are portrayed as being the most courageously different of their representatives of their religion. And so what I'm asking, my question is, what is the cause? Why is it that violence has not been so cleanly rejected by Christianity and Islam? I have a thesis, a hypothesis, and that is that we have yet to provide security, that religion is not seen as a source of security, that when the political chips are down, when the military chips are down, we truly believe, as humans, that our security can only come through violent control of the situation. We win. And so that's what I'm asking is, do you have a thesis for why why neither Christianity nor Islam have been able to clearly differentiate themselves from the violent so clearly as to prevent their being hijacked, except perhaps very peripherally, by such movements?
My thesis is that I am still struggling about these issues, but Islam in particular, religion in general, and its connection to violence and peace things. But my answer is that
for some people, because religion teaches both. Religion teaches both conflict and conflict, violence, and peace. Religion, religious discourses, teaching, symbol, metaphor, and so on and so forth. In some, for the radical Christian and Muslim, they consider to be a violent as a religious, while the moderate said violent is not religious. So I myself still struggling about why some Christians and Muslims use several religious texts, teachings, doctrines, metaphor, and symbol to legitimize their violence simply because religion provides both violence and peace, I think. I don't know if this is answer your question, but I disagree with the question that religion teach neither violence nor peace. But I believe religion teach both violence and peace. A religion contains both violence and peace, and it is easily to people to use or misuse. For radical Muslims, they use these ideas. For the anti-radicalism, they would say they misuse religion. But for the radical, not. I use this religion, not misuse still these religious ideas and so on. So this is a matter of a debate, a matter of a... I'm not convincing myself, actually. Sorry. Thank you so much for coming again. And
well, thank you so much, Sumanto. Let's give him a hand. And thank you for coming.
Thank you.
And thank you, Sumanto. Very good.